Hey everyone, thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today my special guest is Judy Wignall, and she will be talking about extraordinary fireflies. Julie, excuse me, is living proof of the power of unconventional choices, showing there are many paths that lead to happiness and success. At just 14, she left high school to attend an experimental alternative school in the 1970s. While many doubted her path, Julie defied expectations, carving out an extraordinary career spanning national politics, international business, the arts, environmental conservatism, and visionary leadership. Julie's journey from collaborating with corporations to leading innovative conservation initiatives earned her international acclaim and solidified her reputation as a visionary changemaker. Reflecting on her unconventional past, Julie realized she encountered many remarkable people throughout her life and career who, like her, had forged uncommon pathways to create meaningful change. Julie coined the term fireflies to describe these visionaries, people who see beyond what is and take action to create a better reality. A lifelong student of Jungian psychology, metaphysics, and quantum physics, she has synthesized her knowledge and experiences into her multi-award-winning book, The Extraordinary Power of Fireflies, How to Shine Your Light Brighter and Transform the World. Today, Julie is a sought-after consultant, workshop leader, coach, and speaker. She empowers changemakers with the tools to align with their purpose and amplify the impact as she shares what is possible when individuals harness their light to transform the world. For more information, you can visit her website, which is www.extraordinaryfireflies.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Julie to the show. Good day, Julie.
Hi, Robert. Thanks for having me.
I am really looking forward to our conversation. I mean, you're... journey has had so many twists and turns and forks in the road. I think it's wonderful because I doubt during many of those periods, you, if you had known what was coming, you would probably have surprised yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So now, as I mentioned in the introduction, you dropped out of high school at 14 to attend an alternative school in the 70s. So tell us about that. You know, as a teenager, you know, kind of what drove you to do that and defy some other people's, I'm sure, suggestions that you do not do that.
Well, I talk about being unconventional a lot. And in the 1970s, up until that time, I had been a top-performing student, and my mother had decided to get a divorce, and that did not happen then. Now it happens, and it's commonplace, and it's no longer unconventional, but at the time, it was horrible. I had changed schools, and I was immediately targeted as someone who was an at-risk students from a broken home that, and all of a sudden, no matter what I did in school, my grades went down the tubes. And I was absolutely miserable and discovered an alternative school that was project-based and that made the city my playground for learning. And I realized, you know, I thought that I'd had it with learning, I had it with school, and that wasn't true at all. I loved learning, and it excited and reignited my desire to continue to learn about everything. It gave me the opportunity to volunteer in within different organizations, different groups, to explore different things, and it was connected near a university. So I was able to actually take university courses as a 14-year-old. And this wasn't because I was a genius. It wasn't because of anything except the fact that I loved learning. But the response from the community was, well, this is unconventional, and you can't succeed in anything. The world doesn't work that way. And people will say to me today, gosh, if you could go back and tell your younger self anything, what would you tell yourself? And I say, you know what? I would say, you were right. You knew this all along. And I kept those blinders on and said, no, I want to do things, and I want to do them my way. And yes, it led through a very winding path, but it was very unconventional. And I say unconventional in that I'm not rebelling against anything. I'm not fighting against anything. I'm simply trying to live my best life. And what I try to teach people is there are more than one pathway up to the top of the mountain. And if you're doing it one way and it's not working, you know, what happens with the average person, Robert? They go, oh, I tried to do this, and I tried to, you know, do this thing that I was passionate about, and I just, the doors closed in my face. So after so many doors closed in my face, I took the message to say, well, this wasn't meant to be, and it's not what I'm supposed to do. And I say, no, when the door closes in your face, the message is, don't give up. The message isn't to quit. The message is to find another door and find another path. And sometimes those pathways are unconventional.
Yeah, you know, that is so true, that people really often give up when they've run into an obstacle, you know, and their desire. But it is really important to, if one has a passion or a strong desire, to kind of work around that. You know, it's kind of like if you have a boulder or a wall in front of you, you know, walk around it, you know, or over it even, you know, rather than allowing it to stop you from what it is that you desire.
Right. And I think that's the time when, unfortunately, we allow fear to take over.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have that. I mean, fear is universal. And we all have that inner fear of, you know, maybe I'm not good enough, or I don't deserve it, or I don't have a degree, or I have a degree, but it's not the right degree. I mean, it's always something. And when the doors close, it becomes really easy to feed into that fear.
Yeah.
And to say, well, this just isn't for me.
Yeah, yeah. It was when I first started my podcast, which was now going almost 15 years now. But when I first started, I wanted to kind of do my own thing. Prior to that, I was support for a friend who had a radio show, a regular broadcast radio show. And when I had to sometimes step in as a guest, if a guest didn't show, when I heard my voice, you know, in the recording afterwards, I did not like it. I was like, oh my God, you know, it's like, you know, who would want to listen to that voice, you know, kind of thing. And when the opportunity came up, you know, with, you know, podcasting changing dramatically, you know, in the early 2010s, then, you know, again, I kind of looked at the idea of doing my own thing, because I really liked the idea of, you know, talking with individuals and hearing stories. And but I kind of went back again to that fear of, you know, what, first of all, you know, who would want to listen to me? And then second of all, what if it fails? You know, I mean, you know, that is like, you know, it would be devastating. And then a small voice in my head said, you know, just do it. And if you fail, so what? You know, but you might not, you know. And then here I am 15 years later, you know, still talking to people with over 1,500 interviews already done.
Oh, that's fun. But, you know, you raise a really good point. That's a big question that comes up. What if I fail?
Mm-hmm.
And what most people don't realize is those of us who've done all this, oh, Julie, you've done these incredible things. Well, yeah, that's what you see on the surface. What you don't
right.
see are mm-hmm. all the failures that took place that got me to where I am. I always tell people, well, first of all, I believe that we need to start living and creating the world that we want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of failures, you know, I want to live in a world where you can say, oh my gosh, I just tried to do this and oh, did I mess up?
Right.
And I tell you, you know, failure is part of moving forward. Mm-hmm. And I always tell everybody, either fail forward or fail bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's going to take you to what is your success. And, you know, one of the things I've often told clients is sit down and watch an awards show on television and listen to all the people that we sit there at home just so bored, they're going on, they're thanking everybody. But the truth is they're thanking everybody because behind that curtain, they had their own failures. And they're thanking the people that helped to bring them through to get them to where they are today.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the important thing to remember, to you know, keep trying, you know, and keep forging ahead. And you know, if you're met with failure, just kind of examine what you did and what you want to do differently after that.
And that's, yes, and that's where you learn. And I actually have a whole chapter in my book of things that we need to learn, and I talk about that. I studied marine biology, and at one juncture in my career, I was working as the director of programs at the National Aquarium in Washington, D.C., and I decided that I was going to create the very first education program to introduce students who were visually impaired to aquatic life. No one had done this before. And so what I did was I spent 6 months, I was working with the Smithsonian Institution and PhDs from everywhere. And it was a brilliant program. So here comes the day that we're going to pilot the program. I have a group of students coming in from a local school that are all visually impaired. And I showed up, and Robert, it was a disaster. I mean, it was failure with the biggest F you could possibly imagine. And it's like, but I talked to all of these PhDs, and I did this and I did that. Well, they told me that according to statistics, 97% of all the students who are visually impaired actually really have eyesight. It's just a low vision eyesight. So I had created a program geared for this 97%, except that 100% of the kids that showed up were 100% blind.
Oh, no.
So that didn't work at all. We thought we were being very creative and made it multisensory. So there were the sounds playing of the ocean when the kids came in. They knew that they weren't at the beach.
Right.
So after a major fiasco of, you know, trying to feel things but breaking them, and they were just really out of sorts, I stopped the entire program, and I sat the students down. I mean, you got to know when to call the time of death here. But I sat them down, and I said, you know what? I made a huge, huge mistake with this program. I talked to PhDs, and I talked to scientists and to psychologists and to all these things. I forgot to talk to the people that I was trying to reach, and that was the kids themselves. So I worked with the teachers and the students, and I asked the students if they would be willing to help create a program for visually impaired that they could relate to, that they liked, that sounded like a whole lot of fun to them. And I went back to the source, but without that failure.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't been a failure and it had been just so-so, and mm-hmm. everybody had politely said, thank you very much, here would have come another ho-hum program into the world that we didn't need. But because it failed so miserably, it was a chance to sit back and really fall forward. And say, work with me. And I, you know, that becomes the importance of what I call being an advocate before you become an activist. And I refer to that as being an advocate, learning about the people that you're trying to reach and what they need and making them part of the solution. You know, we too often go into communities where we know nothing about what they need or what they're doing, but we've decided as a society, oh, you need this and you need this. We're going to make this all better for you. We have a new program that's going to be wonderful. And it's like, if you want that program to be really successful, become an advocate first. Go into the community and find out what the community is looking for, what they want, and make them a partner so that you can serve them better.
Yeah, that is such an important point, you know, and, you know, one that I think that people can learn from, you know, the fact of advocate before activist, you know, because right now in today's world, we have, you know, a lot of heightened advocacy happening, or activist happening. Yeah, but really not much about the advocates, you know, really kind
but
of looking
exactly
who's affected. Mm-hmm.
And right, and not always communicating. And that's the beauty of fireflies, and that's what I talk about when I talk about the extraordinary power of fireflies. I tell people just to remember, if you've ever seen a firefly and, you know, it's the sun setting in the dusk out in the field or in the yard, that experience is magic. That one tiny little beetle lights up and it lights us up. And it's, I use that as a metaphor to remind us of the magic that we really all have inside of us and the power that we have within each of us in terms of shining our light. Shining our light better and using fireflies as metaphors. Fireflies don't ask for permission. They don't wait to say, oh, is it okay if I shine? No, they just shine. And there, I mean, there are over 2,000 species of fireflies, and they shine in all different colors. There's yellows and greens and blues and oranges and reds. And, you know, this is a family that embraces a huge amount of diversity. But the biggest trick with fireflies is, you know, you were talking about the craziness that's going on today, but fireflies transcends to a place that's beyond politics, beyond and, you know, further and beyond what our culture says is right and appropriate or this and that. They see a need and they see past what is today to what should be and what could be, and they take action to create a better world for everyone, and they just do it.
Yeah, that is, yeah, when I read about the, you know, more than 2,000 different species, I had no idea that there were that many different. It was like, my goodness. And you know, and the idea also in the book talk about synchronicity, how, you know, sometimes they work, you know, in a, you know, synchronistic fashion. And I've seen that, you know, in the nighttime, in the dusk, you know, type of nighttime. And it seems, you know, you used the word magic, you know, it really does seem magical. And particularly when they do their coordinated dance, you know, that it's like, wow, just imagine if we were able to, you know, mimic that and multiply our magic, you know, with others.
And that's the whole point. And, you know, there are two places that we know of in the world, probably more as we explore more. One is in Malaysia and the other is in the Smoky Mountains, where that synchronicity happens in the hundreds. And I mean, it lights up a late night forest. It's enchanting. You can have hundreds of fireflies that shine their light and are blinking in a pattern, and they're talking to another group that are of another hundred, and they're shining, and it lights up the entire forest. And, you know, and so you think about it, if I shine my light, you shine your light, well, we're all trying to make the world a better place. Well, as we all shine in unison and we start doing this in terms of synchronicity, the world becomes a better place. We each do this in our own way. And that's the beauty of it. We're each doing something different. We're each reaching different groups of people, different parts of, you know, the world or the environment or social justice or whatever, through music, through the arts. But everybody that's doing that and following their inner light and they're shining it brighter, they're making a huge impact on the world. And, you know, that firefly is the reminder when someone says, but what can I do? Who am I to have an impact? Well, go back and remember of the impact and magic of that tiny little one firefly. And imagine how much more pronounced it is when we all begin shining our light together.
Exactly. Wow. Very much so. You started your career working in politics, international business, and the arts, but then found your way to science in environmental conservation. Now, environmental awareness is kind of one of the side programs I do, because I just think it's so important to raise awareness about our environment and our custody of the environment. And and I noticed in one of you mentioned that you had done a program with Jacques Cousteau. I had his son Jean-Michel Cousteau on, and you know, he really, for his and his time, you know, he really did wonderful work in raising environmental awareness. So I would like
Let me add to that. That's what I think really important. And I would think about how famous he became, how well known he became, and think about how much input he had in terms of the world of marine science. He was not a marine biologist. He didn't have the right degrees in science. He didn't follow that conventional, this is what you have to do something. He just did it. That's a firefly. He just did it.
Yeah. So how did you go from that what was the transition from the politics to environmental conservation? Because I'm curious that maybe there are listeners who may want to make the transition themselves.
And I've worked with a lot of people who've made huge transitions from one career to another. I had worked two presidential campaigns and then for a congressman for a year and a half. And while I was working for the congressman, I was helping in the legislative office. I was working on environmental issues. And I found it fascinating and I really enjoyed it, but at the same time I also thought that I was going to have a career in the theater, so exploring that too. I would say, you know, we meet those little kids that are like 4 or 5 and they go, I'm going to be a doctor when I grow up, or I'm going to be a dentist, and they do. And then there are those of us that, well, we're not really sure, maybe I want this, maybe I want that. But all those different areas lead us to where we need to be.
Right.
And I ended up getting completely burned out. I'd had it with politics. I was working with different political nonprofits and social justice things. And I said, I need a break. And my mother called it my beach bum days. I went and I moved to Mexico and I worked for an international resort teaching snorkeling. And while I was out teaching snorkeling every day, I began to understand that there were certain rhythms of the ocean. I began to pick up on the seasons of the ocean. And I met a gentleman who lived there who was what they call a shark caller. He would send me out and he'd say, Julie, go out, swim out here, come back, tell me what you see. And I'd say, nothing. There's no fish. There's no, you know, we have to go back out further to the reefs, which were not in great shape. And he would say, okay, and he would go out. And he would sit in the middle of the ocean, and not that deep, you know, just sit by himself, and very quietly. And within 15, 20 minutes, there would be sharks surrounding him. There would be fish. And when I say sharks, I'm not talking about great white sharks. I'm talking about little nurse sharks. But you
right.
see dolphins
mm-hmm.
jumping around. But just attracting all this wildlife. And I thought, I don't know what this guy is doing, but this is like a whole thing of the ocean, and I love it, and I want to know more. And I ended up coming back to the United States and applied to universities and went and studied marine biology in Australia off the coast of the Great Barrier Reef, which sounds wonderful, but in the area where I was, it's pretty choppy waters getting out to the Great Barrier Reef, and I was living in the outback area where they needed a lot of help working on cattle stations. So I actually did my time with cattle stations as well as working out in the ocean. But the biggest thing that I learned when I came back to the United States and I ended up working with the National Aquarium in Washington, D.C., is there's a term called consilience, and we need more of it. The concept of consilience is the concept of linking different fields of study to create a better understanding of the world. And it's kind of like a holistic approach to everything. So when people say to me, yes, but I've had teachers who say, oh, I have my background as a teacher, but I really would love to work with a zoo or aquarium or a museum. Well, you know what? Those zoos, those aquariums, museums, they need you.
Mm-hmm.
Or somebody says, you know what, I'm not great with chemistry and math, but I'd really like to do something for the environment. I want to be a filmmaker. Well, they need you.
Right.
Bottom line is everybody has certain superpowers, and whatever it is, the world needs you, and the world needs you to use it because we need to be looking at things through a different lens. When I came back to Washington, I attended the USDA Graduate School. And they got very angry at me because I kept taking the same ecology course over and over and over again. And they said, but you've already passed it. Why would you do this again? I said, because one time you had ecology and it was being taught by a biologist. Well, that's one perspective to look at in terms of ecology. But the next time you did it, you had it being taught by someone who was a chemist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're looking at it completely differently. And then the third time you have someone who's an economist teaching ecology is looking at this from a completely different perspective. And if we want to move forward and pass and have that paradigm shift to move past the problems that we have today, we have to have that skill of being able to look at things from all of these different perspectives. Which is why, you know, I can say, oh, as a scientist, I can give you a long lecture on environmental conservation for an hour and a half. But if I'm an artist, I can come and draw a picture or create a sculpture that immediately connects with your emotional center, or I could tell you a story that's going to have a lot more impact than my scientific list of these are the things that you should know. As human beings, we connect with stories and we connect
right.
with things emotionally. So if we want to connect with each other or we want to find solutions to things, when we do it through storytelling, through the arts, through music, everybody relates to music.
Yeah, very much.
When we go through those different avenues, we have the opportunity to make a much grander impact.
Yeah, that's very true. And you know, consilience, boy, that's one word that I've now added to my vocabulary. I love the idea of that, and so I'm going to be kind of keeping that in mind, And
feel free to use it.
This is that I will educate others along the way. One of the things that you were talking about, like the teacher who wanted to do work, in a kind of an ecological environment, and you're talking about people. Their skills can be applied, where there's need. Now, reading your biography, I noticed that volunteerism was a part of your journey. And it seems that method would be very useful for those who want to reach out or branch out, you know, to their desire from where they are.
I love that you brought that up because it's a huge, huge point. And I still volunteer with different things today because that's how you create community. Mm-hmm. But when I was working as the director of programs for the National Aquarium, I would have a lot of adults, kids, whatever, would come in and say, you know, I would love to work in this kind of a situation, but I don't know how to do it, or through a zoo or whatever. And I used to tell everybody, get in and volunteer. In most places, it will take you less than a month to go, oh my gosh, I have found, this is nirvana to me. I am as ecstatic as could be. Or you go, it's really not what I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. Then you haven't lost anything. You take that experience and you move on to the next thing, the volunteer. But for that month that you've been there, you've actually helped someone and you've helped a group. And I also tell people, you know, when they go, I don't have the right background for this. Well, you never know. And I have to tell you, you know, as someone who hired people, if I had a choice, and this was true with most people in many fields, if I have a choice to hire someone who I see their work ethic, I see what they're willing to do, what they're willing to learn, the lengths that they're going to, if I have the chance to hire that person or to choose someone else who's never volunteered, they've never stepped foot in a community setting. They go, oh, not unless you're paying me. But maybe they've got the right degrees or anything. I have to tell you, 9 out of 10 of us are going to hire the person who's volunteering.
Yeah. Yeah. That shows the dedication and the extra effort that someone would put forth.
Right. And as a supervisor, a manager or director, you want to create teams that work well together. Well, someone who's volunteered and has already shown that they're working well with everyone, you go, well, this is just a perfect new fit to this whole puzzle of this collective community that we're creating. So I either choose that with someone who's already got a track record, or now I could also choose someone who just has the right credentials. Much yeah. rather have the person who's right there.
Yeah, definitely so. Now, you did another one of your, you know, wonderful transitions from Washington, D.C. to working in the hotel and casino with Steve Wynn in Las Vegas. Now, that is a major shift, you know. I mean, I lived in Las Vegas. I know, you know, kind of what it takes to become you know, successful in that particular environment. So tell us about that transition and how that came about.
Well, interestingly enough, I was in Washington, D.C. Now, here's again, let me pull the curtains back. It sounds very impressive. I was working as the director of programs for the National Aquarium. I was also at the same time working for the National Zoo and the Smithsonian. Oh, that sounds so impressive, doesn't it? Well, actually, I was doing all three jobs because I needed those three jobs to be able to pay the bills.
Very practical.
That's how poorly, you know, we were paid at that time in that area. And then at the same time, I was also working and volunteering with different environmental organizations. And I know everybody was looking for money. The environmental organization said, oh, we've got to do it every other day. We started another fundraising campaign. There was always a fundraising campaign for the aquarium. I had an education staff that would say, Julie, what's our budget for next month? And we had a wishing well in the front that had pennies. And my answer was always, go and count whatever pennies are out there, you can have. That's your budget for the next month. And everybody thought, you know, big business is greedy and they're horrible and terrible corporations. people need to give money to us, and they're not. And I said, but we're not doing anything except constantly raising money. And I sat down and I thought about it, and I said, you know, big business and corporations are not greedy. People are greedy. Mm-hmm. There can be people working within corporations and big business that are greedy, but if there are people who are greedy, maybe there are people who are not greedy. And maybe there are people who are willing to listen. And I thought, I wonder what could happen if you have someone who is into environmental conservation who works hand in hand with a major corporation. And I got the chance to do it once when one day I got a crazy call from Las Vegas, Nevada, saying to me, you know, we want to do an aquarium and we want to have dolphins. We have the Siegfried and Roy group that have lions and tigers and an elephant, and we would love you to do this. And I went, oh my God, that sounds terrible. I, you know, thought Las Vegas, and I'm thinking like a really cheap hotel, and they're going to try to put mm-hmm. animals in the parking lot. I'm going to go, that's terrible. Please don't do this. And the question came back from their lead architect where he said, I'm not asking you, should we do it? I'm not asking your opinion. I'm asking you, can we do it? Mm-hmm. And I went, that's a different question. Well, if you follow the laws and you do what you need to do, yes, you can do it. And the next thing I know, they asked me to come out to Las Vegas and talk to this man, Steve Wynn, who I had never heard of before. And this was at the time where Steve was just beginning to, mm-hmm. to make money. And he had a vision for completely transforming Las Vegas. And we worked together for 13 and a half years. And I really did learn mm-hmm. what could happen when an environmental activist mm-hmm. joins hands with a multimillionaire running a Fortune 500 company. And what we were able to do was nothing short of miraculous. I, you know, because of that, I was able to set new standards for the care and nurturing of dolphins and other marine mammals and fish all over the world, working with Siegfried and Roy and their animals. I got to do the same thing with setting new standards for exotic cats. But it wasn't just that, because it was a corporation, I also got to have input on what was carried in our retail shops. I mean, we were the first hotel and casino that said, no, we're not carrying furs. I said, you can't do that and say that you're committed to animals. You're right, no furs. And Steve was probably the biggest animal rights activist I think I've ever worked with. Mm-hmm. And he said, you're absolutely right, we can't do that. And I said, okay, so we're building a facility for dolphins. Well, we're in Las Vegas. I want only dolphins that are already in captivity and dolphins that cannot be released to the wild.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I said, let's go find animals that need homes, and let's give them a really good home. And then let's make their home three times bigger than the government says it needs to be. And let's give them an artificial reef, coral reef to play around in. And I said, I know, by the way, I need to be doing educational programs because Las Vegas is the eighth largest school district in the United States.
Wow.
And I said, we have to do education programs. And I can't do that when I have your guests coming in from the casino. I said,
really?
And we can't even open until 11 o'clock in the morning. Before that, I want to be open only for education programs. And I said, and I also can't expect school kids to come traipsing through your hotel and casino. I need a special entrance for them. And this needs to be all made available to them for free. And the answer was yes, 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 and yes.
Wow.
Which was amazing. And we also got to have input on restaurants, the type of fish we were serving, sustainable seafood, and working, you know, internationally in terms of helping other facilities and working as like a circular economy to say that's where we started recycling gray water and looking at areas where the entire corporation could become more environmentally sustainable.
Wow, that's wonderful, you know, and it's that kind of vision that spreads. It kind of ripples, you know, through the various industries, you know, for people to observe and to, you know, create similar types of situations that really improve, you know, our connection with the animal world and also with the environment.
Right. Well, and think about, you know, this was a huge corporation, and but all the employees were all on board, and people in all that, you know, working with chefs, they loved being able to, you know, I didn't walk in and just say, oh, you can't do this, and this is really bad, and you shouldn't be using this fish. It's like, you know what, here's a better choice that's sustainable, and you should be proud of that. And they loved that. Every different department and aspect of the hotel was really on board as becoming a part of something bigger. And everybody wants to have, you know, a healthy environment and places where we can, like, reconnect with nature. And, you know, they no longer were like, oh, this are Julie's animals. It was like, these are our animals.
Yeah.
This is our place. And, you know, these are places, and I work at a place where I can be proud.
So, Julie, you coined the term fireflies to describe visionaries, people who see beyond what is and take action to create a better reality. And I know in your book, Extraordinary Fireflies, you give some examples. So would you mind sharing with the listeners just, you know, an example of a firefly that you really enjoy or are impressed with?
Yes, and I know that you've mentioned your interest in scents and aromatherapy. One of the people that I spoke, that I wrote about, is Amy Christensen. And Amy began as an international, like a social worker, and she worked all around the world, spent a lot of time working in Africa and time in Morocco. And she began learning that female flower harvesters in Morocco only have access to work a few times a year when the orange blossoms and the jasmine and the roses are in bloom. Well, the byproduct of those harvests usually ended up in a landfill.
Mm-hmm.
But Amy was there. Amy had a different idea. She created she didn't want to create just a basic thing for scents and fragrances. She wanted to create a luxury fragrance. And she began working with these women, took all of this out of the landfill, recreated it with a new business model for a conscious luxury fragrance that goes under the name of Santa Jardin. And it empowers these low-income women in Morocco. And Amy, she could have stopped there in terms of what she's doing for the women and empowering them and giving them a future, but she also works to make sure that her packaging is environmentally friendly, that the glass she uses in terms of what the perfumes are in are made of as much recycled glass as possible. And she's bringing a new face to what business looks like. So, but people, as I said, you could be fireflies in all kinds of different ways. She certainly is a pioneer as the founder of this luxury fragrance house. But people do this in all different ways.
Yeah.
One of the people I've written about is an Australian artist who created a art installation that was supposed to be temporary, that was so popular it was made permanent, called Forgotten Songs. He was at a natural history museum in Sydney, Australia, and was listening to some lectures about all of the birds, that the songbirds that have disappeared from urban neighborhoods there because of the building and growth. So he came up as an artist with a different way to present artwork, where he has empty bird cages all the way down a street called Forgotten Songs, down one of the streets in an urban neighborhood. And then he added the bird songs, you know, what are we missing? Well, what a great way to inspire people to share information. It's not a lecture. It's not a somebody telling you what to do. It's somebody making you aware. And right. He went so far as he actually worked with scientists so that the bird songs changed by the season. And based on how long, like, the daylight is. And just his process in terms of learning this to express and explain this to the public has been just as powerful as people who go and visit it. And today people show up to visit this from all around the world.
Wow, that's wonderful. Those are excellent examples. Now, in your book, you also include chapters on lessons we've forgotten and lessons we need to learn. So what are like a couple examples that would fall within each of those categories?
Lessons. Yes, lessons we've forgotten, that everything is connected.
Mm.
We learn in biology that, oh, everything is connected and what you do to one animal is connected to another animal. It's bigger than that. Everything is connected. And it's back to that concept of consilience, that everything is important and we are all connected. And in terms of lessons we need to learn the power of community, of working together, and of working across generations.
Mm.
We are so focused in our society today of saying, oh, this is going to be a youth-led movement, or this is a senior citizen-led movement. And it's like we need more human-led movements that incorporate people from all different generations. When I go to work on new projects, the ultimate is to have someone in their 80s and 90s who not only has wisdom to share, but has an attitude of gratitude, where it's really living in the moment and being happy with just being here. That's really important. You get your 40-year-olds and your 50-year-olds that are at a completely different place, and they've now got experience and things that they want to share, lessons that they've learned. They need to share that. And what they have to say is really important. You have the 20 and 30-year-olds that are striving to figure things out, and they're not sure, but they're new, and they're ready to take risks, and they're ready to fail if need be. And then we need those 10-year-olds that remind us all to have fun and to be happy.
Yeah. I had on my show now, gosh, probably 10 years ago, a pair of children who started a nonprofit called One More Generation. And they started the young girl wanted to, you know, support a rhino, you know, make a contribution for the support of a rhino. But that nonprofit grew to a tremendous level that they were, you know, traveling internationally, speaking to youth groups, you know, and really, you know, motivating the youth. I mean, you know, and I've been impressed with some of the young folks of today that I see, you know, going out there and, you know, recognizing that they can make a difference, you know, no matter what their age.
I believe we all start that way.
Yeah.
We all believe that we've got the power within us to do great things. Unfortunately, what happens is we grow up within a cultural society that's got certain rules that say, not really. It's no different than when kids are in elementary school. We tell them, oh, you can grow up to be anything that you want to be. But as soon as you start hitting those teenage years, you start hearing, you know, it's time to start thinking about your 401k and your health insurance and what you're going to do that's really going to earn an income. And, you know, here are these teenagers going, but wait a minute, I thought I could grow up to be anything. Yeah, but we kind of said that, but we didn't really mean it.
Right, exactly.
We really need to mean it. And, you know, we need to provide tools. That's one of the reasons I also, you know, I work as a coach with helping people, because we need to be reminded of that. We need to be reminded of that over and over again. And I find a lot of people that have become very successful do so working with coaches or through having mentors, or other people who really kind of provide that stability to say, yes, you're everything that you thought you were and you can't give up now.
Yeah.
You're allowed to take downtime. You're allowed to rest, recoup, and recover, but you're not allowed to give up.
Yeah, that is something. Now, speaking of your coaching work, I did recognize on your website, extraordinaryfireflies.com, that people can grab a free discovery call or schedule a free session just to gain some insight. They can do that from your website, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And I do that. It's not a sales call. There's no sales pitch or anything. A lot of people don't understand what it means to work with a coach. And today is a fabulous period of time because there are tons of people like me that offer this free. This is the experience of what it is to work with a coach, just so you know what it is. And maybe maybe I'm the right person, maybe I'm not, but it's going to encourage you to try other people's free coaching calls. It's like finding a therapist. It's like finding the right one, and at least you know what it is. And maybe it's a good fit for now, or maybe you go, you know, I've got this mentor that's really filling this role for me. Maybe I don't need this, or maybe it's something in the future.
Right.
But it's an opportunity to introduce people to what that looks like. And the other thing that I do have on the website is an easy free download of flying lessons for fireflies. And it's just 5 basic, simple exercises, powerful exercise to help anyone start shining brighter right now. Start getting clarity, start taking the next step to move forward. And what that does when you download that, you become part of the community, and I send out a weekly email, just one short, simple, sweet, something that is inspiring or encouraging to say, keep at it, and let's just remember the magic that you carry inside of you.
Wow, that's wonderful. Well, Julie, I could talk to you forever, but we run out of time. But now I did do a Facebook friend request, so hopefully we'll be following each other there. As well as on your website, too. At the top, people can also join you on Instagram and LinkedIn. So if they want to use those, if they use those social media platforms, that's one way of getting in touch with you. So I really want to thank you for your time. This has really been a wonderful conversation. I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Oh, and I want to thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
Great. You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Julie Wignall, and we've been talking about her work, journey, and her book, The Extraordinary Power of Firefly, How to Shine Your Light Brighter and Transform the World, which is available at any of your fine book outlets. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to shine your bright light and bring inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.